This is one in a series of podcasts from the Hyatt Webb Conference in Austin, 2011.
Hey, everybody. Can I see a show of hands? Who's bought, like, a big ticket item in the past year? Like, I'm talking cars. I had to buy a car right after PSU Webb. Thanks, Robin. Car, refrigerator, computer. How'd you feel about that purchase? How did you go about making that purchase? How did you do research? Thank you, Logan. I appreciate that. There is a prize for participation. We'll start off with that. I don't know if anybody knows, but the Girls Gone Woo-Woo have calendars. So whoever's the best participator gets a free calendar, okay? So how did you make your decision? Logan says he went to the internet. Did anybody... Consumer Reports, research, that kind of thing. Okay, Consumer Reports. Okay. Did you talk to family and friends, about, you did? Okay. Oh, well, that's convenient. You didn't have a choice what car you got, right? Were you, like, conflicted to make the decision? Like, who's trying to decide if they're going to get a new iPhone? Who's already gotten a new iPhone? And who's like going, I don't know if I want to invest that right now. I'm in that boat because I just got a 4, a couple months ago. And afterwards, after you made that big purchase, how did you feel? Come on, shout it out at me.
Warm and fuzzy.
Sweet. What did you buy, a kitten? Okay. How did you feel, Georgie? Okay, anybody who bought a car, after I bought my car, I loved it. It made me very happy, and it's cute, and it's in the parking lot out there. Okay, so you had a little noise involved, a little cognitive dissonance. Oh, did you want the new car? See, that's what I wanted. I'd made enough child car choices for... It is what it is. So that's exactly the kind of thing we're going to be talking about today. Not buying cars, not buying refrigerators, not buying phones. We're going to be talking about how to get students to make that decision, to implement a decision, to commit to you guys, to y'all's universities, or alumni to make a decision to give money, or just people to make a decision to like your school. I mean... In the end, that's what we want. That's all what we want. So the decision to buy and implement the use of something new is the thing that we're going to talk about today. But first, we're going to get started. I'm going to tell you who I am. Just Robin's told you a little bit, but I'm going to go a little bit more into detail. And we're going to talk about why you should care. You should care because we should care about people. And then we're going to talk about who you guys are. And I do care. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about what we're talking about today. So my professors say, you say what you're going to say, you say what you're going to say, and then you tell people what you said. Did I say what I'm going to say? Yeah? Okay. Okay, so this is me at a glance. I'm the Director of Communications at the UALR William H. Bowen School of Law. It's kind of hard to say that, but we have to differentiate ourselves because we are not the flagship university of the state. I'm the co-chair for the regional high ed web, R, Hiwi Bar. Y'all might have seen that hashtag back in July. I'm also co-chair of the high ed web regional support committee, so if you guys are interested in starting a regional, I'm one of the people you can come to along with Jason Woodward. And just this past December, I earned my master's degree in applied communication studies at UALR. And what that means is that I just took some stuff that they were telling me and tried to use it, and this is part of what I did. I'm very interested in Twitter. This happens to be, I think, my favorite area of social media just because of the immediacy and the ability that people have to use it regardless of the fact that they feel like they may not be a good writer or particularly adept at communicating their thoughts. It's really easy to use. Prior to joining the Bowen School, I worked for Main Campus. And our campus, my school has about 500 students. Main Campus has about 13,000 students. And I want Megan to wave her hand. She's at my campus, too. And she's kind of going to be taking over the job that I used to do, maybe, kind of. And Megan's a High Ed Web virgin, so yay. So this presentation is a result of a lot of that work that I did when I earned my master's degree in applied communication studies. I got sick and tired of, in the curriculum that we had, taking the interpersonal classes. We had a lot of interpersonal classes. And I call that granola theory, because it didn't feel like it was particularly applicable to what I was doing at any point in time. So when I took the class Diffusion of Innovations, which is the theory that this research is based in, I found something that I could grab a hold to. And what the theory talks about is getting people to adopt what you want them to adopt. And it's not evil. It's just the way we all work. I used Twitter in my thesis because I had a lot of professors who talked about the fact that social media is a passing fad. Can we all have a general laugh? Ha, 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 ha. It's a passing fad, I was told. It is not valid interpersonal communication, I was told. I think through this research that I showed that it is valid interpersonal communication, and we use it every day, and I really don't care at this point if my professors think it's a load of hooey. Okay, so let's talk about you guys. You've heard ad nauseum about me. How many of you have personal Twitter accounts? Okay. How many of you manage accounts for universities, colleges? Okay. That's interesting. You don't have a personal account, but you manage an account? I'm sorry? Okay. That's managing an account. How many of you have more than one account that you manage? I'd have given an award for that. You know, how many times have you tweeted from the wrong account? Like, ugh. So do you sometimes feel like there's no rhyme or reason to what you're putting out there? Yes, no? Can I see a... Yes, no rhyme or reason? There's no logical reason I should put this stuff out here, but somebody told me to do it, so I put it out there. Do you feel like your messaging sometimes gets bogged down in exactly the tool, the restrictions of the tool? Okay, well, that's something that we have issues with every day in what I'm doing. Especially, I communicate with attorneys all day, and I don't know if y'all have communicated with attorneys a lot, but it's a little different than talking to normal people. Please don't tweet that. Because they take everything literally. So on the agenda today, we're going to talk about the background for Diffusion of Innovation. We're going to talk about the theory. We'll talk about the research that we conducted. And then we'll talk about the results and the practical applications, which is, I know what you guys want to get to. Y'all don't want to listen to me talk about what I did for 2 years. So the background, why did I talk about Twitter? Well, I told you, I think that it's a valid communication medium. I think it's got mass media elements, and I think it's got interpersonal elements. The prevalence is more and more out there. We've used it, you know, y'all know all this stuff. Recently, I thought it was really interesting to watch when Steve Jobs died, because saw it on Twitter, then I saw it on the TV, and it was just amazing to me to see this happen live. It was like these other instances that I've got up here. I don't know if y'all know, but 200 million tweets a day. That's an astronomical number. And there are millions of users, and we know that there are some who are super users and there are some who are not. And I think probably we have a lot of super users in this building today. And then I focused on H1N1 and the use of Twitter to communicate information about H1N1. Am I doing that? Do you know? Oh, okay. We'll go all Janet Jackson from the 80s. thank you, Georgie. H1N1 was a health catastrophe that we anticipated. Who was on their campus when H1N1, like, when we started talking about it? Started talking about communication plans for it. What are we going to do if we get a bunch of kids who are in a dorm who are sick? So we actually anticipated that, and I remember sitting in the first meeting going, we don't know what's going to happen. And we could use other communication vehicles during the outbreak so I could kind of look and compare as to how the information came to people. It was like a perfect storm for me, honestly. I was looking for a topic for my thesis, and it was a right place, right time kind of thing. I was in the midst of this communication plan for H1N1 to talk to our students, and bam, this happened. So I could do my research at the same time that I was working, and that's nice when you can actually do that. I also was able to use what I learned in my work. It may not have materialized then, but it certainly has materialized since then in using it in what I do. So the theory we're talking about, who's heard of diffusion of innovation? Mark is usually I look back in the back and Mark's sitting back there. Okay, so 1, 2, 3, Megan. 4, 5. Y'all all should get this book and read it. It's not a hard read, right, Megan? Okay. It's not a hard read. It by Ev Rogers. Ev grew up in rural Iowa and studied, he was a sociologist, studied how how farmers adopted crop innovations and saw that there was a curve that developed. And people talked to fellow farmers and learned that, oh, your wheat is growing better than my wheat, so I'm going to try what you try. He was also a supreme networker, and I think that most everybody in this room should be a supreme networker, or at least try to be. And that just means making connections and helping other people make connections. So diffusion is the process by which innovation is communicated through certain channels over time among the members of the social system. And, you know, blah, 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 right? Jeez, y'all are quiet. Blah, blah. So the innovation is a new thing. The communication is either mass media or interpersonal. And over time, so we watch the adoption through members of the social system. And the social system is the important thing that we have to worry about because we're considered change agents, so we have to develop a system for ourselves. So this is the steps that we go through in, and I'm going to jump off here. These are the steps that we go through in communication of innovation. And my research focused on these three initial stages. The information stage, that's when you just get your good goo in your brain. The persuasion stage is when you try to adopt a decision. The decision stage is when you get to the point where you've made your decision, then you implement, and confirmation is that end where we're talking about, you said you weren't happy with the car, right? You're in confirmation stage with that car. And that's where cognitive dissonance comes in. Okay, so what does this have to do with your work, right? Yeah? No? What does theory have to do with my work? Well, just like people talked about H1N1 ad nauseum, it felt like, you know, I'm getting sick, I'm getting cold, I don't know what, I'm sitting by this guy on the train, he's coughing. They talk about everything, right? I mean, Mike talked about it yesterday in his presentation, where you want to give some people something good to talk about, and you want to give them the right channels to talk about, where they're going to talk about stuff regardless. No matter the platform, we just have to think about how to use them, and I mean use in the best sense, to communicate what we want them to communicate. So let's talk a little bit about my research, and don't let the numbers scare you. Over 300,000 lost a zero, tweets used one of three terms, and this is hashtag and just in the content of the tweet in the 140 characters, H1N1 swine flu, or swine flu, the two words, during the height of the outbreak. And we took the time from spring to fall 2009 because that's when the outbreak happened. So what we did was we isolated tweets for one of three key days in the outbreak. And April 25th was when the World Health Organization met to discuss the epidemic. So news reports peaked tweets at that time. September 4th was when there started to be a lot of deaths in Mexico. Do y'all remember that? And I think probably particularly in Texas and areas down here, people started to kind of freak out. Oh, my God, did you go to Mexico? Are you getting sick? You know, that kind of thing. And then October 24th was the date that Obama declared a national health emergency. Y'all remember that? So each of those days were days that were particularly salient. And does anybody know what salience means? What's it mean? Important or relevant to a viewer, reader, somebody involved in the story. And salience is one of those key things, key terms that we need to remember when we're communicating with people. So we isolated for those 3 days and came out with 15,000 tweets. That's 15,000 tweets. Now, originally, I had 1,200 pages of content that I needed to look at for a content analysis. Do y'all know how big of a stack of paper that is? It's like that big. It's ridiculous. So we had to figure out how to narrow the scope. And so we narrowed it down to 15,000 tweets, and that's still a whole heck of a lot. Then we conducted a detailed reading of 5,000 tweets for content, just to see what people were saying and what people were looking for, what kind of information they were looking for. And this is the kind of thing that we can use every day in our work when we're communicating in whatever way. So after that, after the content analysis, we did a survey of Twitter users. And I actually tweeted out the link. So if anybody took my survey, I thank you. I appreciate it greatly. And we talked to them about, did you get vaccinated? How did you make your decision? Where did you find your information? And we also talked to them about their behaviors on Twitter as a whole. And that was probably the most telling. Not the stuff that had to do with H1N1 and specifically, but the stuff that had to do with what they do every day with the tool. So with the results, the content analysis lent three themes. People go on Twitter, or come to anything for that matter, for information seeking and sharing. They also share misinformation, which is the scary thing, and you'll see when we get further on in this that the misinformation is perhaps one of the most just erg things. And then there's uncertainty reduction. For instance, I'm having a reaction to my shot and I can't figure out what I'm supposed to do. We have a lot of that in higher education. Think about when you've got a fire alarm that happens in a dorm and you have somebody tweet about it. And, you know, if you're not watching and not paying attention to it, then that uncertainty builds and there's a void of information. And as we found with other emergencies, people will fill that void with misinformation. So the results on the survey of users were very interesting. We asked, how often do you pass along information? How do you choose what information to pass along? And how do you verify the truth of the information that you see on Twitter? And then how does that information impact your decisions? This is where we get scary and hinky, people. The majority of our users pass along information 1 to 3 times a day. However, we've got super users who tweet 10 or more times a day. How many times a day do you tweet? Estimate. I know I do. I did an analysis. I do like 20 a day. It depends on how hard I'm working. You know, do you, like, 1 to 3? Who thinks you're 1 to 3 times a day? Who thinks you're like 5 to 10? How many do, Georgie, estimate? You just have to be below me, right? But I think for people who talk as for a living, it's not a whole lot. I mean, I get paid to talk. And those people are the people we need to latch a hold of and make use of. Just like when we're trying to find bloggers, we need to find people who are involved. You know, Mike talked about that yesterday, too. So when we asked individuals how they chose to pass along information, this was really interesting to me. This is a direct quote. I had one respondent who said, "I pass along something of interest that comes from someone who I know who isn't in my circle of followers." So that shows that people are paying attention to, like, hashtags, like stuff that's in their area of interest, but they may not want to follow that individual. So, you know, you never know who's going to be watching your stuff. Those individuals, the individuals who pass along stuff, are the connective tissue for our communities. And I called, in the earlier presentation, I called Robin one of those major connectors, because she is. She manages to bring people together. We have a lot of them in this room. You guys can be major connectors for your different audiences, and that's a really good role to have, because that means you're valuable to your community, but you're not always valuable as a mouthpiece. The second scary thing to me about doing this survey and doing the research was the answer to the verification of the truth of the information on Twitter. Do you verify what you see on Twitter? I want to see a show of hands in here. So you look up every link. Click on every link. Okay. And say you see somebody say something that looks like it may be true but not. Do you pass along? Yeah. But do you verify before you do it? Okay. Really? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if y'all in the back heard, but he's talking about the Steve Jobs. When Steve Jobs died, that was his immediate reaction, was to go verify the information before he retweeted. That's awesome. That's awesome responsible behavior as a Twitter user. Because the people who are following us do not verify information. That was scary. I had a quote from somebody who said, "I trust everyone I follow. Therefore, I do not look up anything before I retweet." How scary is that? How bad could that be if somebody put out something that was not true? And you had your hand up?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Catastrophic evening that ended up being completely false. There wasn't an element of truth to it. That gray line of, especially for a teacher, when you pass along, kind of engaged, the students are already grieving,
And you're dealing with a vulnerable population, too. And when we're dealing with students, and particularly parents, we're dealing with vulnerable populations, too. But that was the thing that I looked at the results of the survey and went, I can't believe this, we got to do this again. So I went back and talked to a subset of users and said, "You mean to tell me that you don't check what you see?" And they said, "No, we don't check what we see." There are certain populations, but you expect people who are on certain media, at least I do, to be smart about what they're doing, you know? Anybody could respond, but that was one of the questions that we had on the survey, and that's interesting. I've never been asked that question. I did not have anybody below 18 respond, which doesn't surprise me because of the average user on Twitter. Mostly they were like 24 to 40-ish in that area, you know, which we know is the time that people use it. Okay, so let's get, you know, and the verification of the information is really not any different. I mean, if your mom tells you something, are you going to go check it out? I'm not. It's my mom. Really? So what's different now about the way we communicate with people? And I think that this Michael Schuller quote is awesome. And he's talking about traditional media. He's not talking about social media. But I think that it applies to us as well. People expect to share information. We're creating a two-way communication channel. Not be fed it. They expect to be listened to. And they want control over their information. And, you know, we've always known this. It seems like now we have to be even more careful about what we spit out as Twitter spitter outers, because that's what we are. We have to make sure that we don't abuse the trust of individuals, because they're going to talk about us if they find out that we've lied about something or that we haven't corrected something. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about what influence means, because influence is that thing that we have to be careful about. There's been research lately that it's not all your follower number that's the big thing. There are three different methods of influence. There's in-degree influence, retweet influence, and mention influence. And I think y'all can all, you know, define this. In-degree is your number of followers. Retweet is the number of times you're retweeted. And mention is the number of times you're mentioned in a tweet. Okay, so now let's talk about the application for what, you know, this research means. You want to stand up and do some calisthenics? I had to get my obligatory kitten picture in. So this is what the research showed me. People trust what we put out, so we have to share in a trustworthy manner. We have to make sure that what we spit out is absolutely true. Don't share misinformation if you know it's misinformation, and squelch it if it pops up. Okay, but I mean squelch in the nicest possible way. You know, don't be rude, don't be mean. Don't create a highly verbal enemy who has a mouthpiece, because they do at that point. And if you call somebody out and get all snarky with them, it's just not going to work. Number two, promise your viewers or readers absolutely correct information and then give them ways to verify it. I found that even if people didn't click on the links, it made them feel better to have the links there, you know, when I was conducting the follow-up surveys. It made them feel like, okay, I can check it out if I feel like it, but I don't feel like it. Set yourself up to be a trusted source, or better yet, set other people up to be a mouthpiece and a trusted source for you. And we've talked about this a lot in other areas. That's why we have students blog. That's why we have students make videos. You know, we can set up other people to be our mouthpieces. And sometimes that's more valuable to other people, to our followers. So stamp out that information, or enable somebody to stamp out that information for you. Sometimes what I'll do is, if we have something coming up at school, I will call one of the students I know who is a big tweeter and say, hey, can you put out something about this? Because I know that the students are listening to you and they may not be listening to me. Now, they may at me for more information about an event, But if I can send that student out and create an opinion leader in them, then they're more willing to give more information for me. Have y'all, I mean, it's we do that all the time with other things. How many people have student bloggers or tweeters or anything like that? I mean, it's the same concept. You're just creating opinion leaders by feeding them information. We've done it with journalists for a long time. I mean, if you want a favorable story, what do? You give them the information ahead of time so that you can kind of sculpt the messaging. Now, I'm going to say something. Don't screw the people who tweet for you, who tweet about you, who are positive about you. Don't give them bad information and help them be your best mouthpiece. I have seen students call out alumni before on Twitter because they are communicating negative things about our school. And I want those people to continue to do that kind of thing. So we have tweet-ups where we bring them in and we talk to them about what our messaging is and what we're going to roll out so they can get a sneak peek and they can work on things for us in the coming months. So I'm not screwing them over. Okay, don't wait to share your information. There is a narrow point where we have salience, and that's why we looked at those three specific dates. In the research. So take advantage of that slot that you have to fit into and fill it. Sharing information at the right time, at the right place is the important thing. The propensity for individuals to share information, for instance, during H1N1, I don't know if y'all saw, but Lindsay Lohan got a little ill and she tweeted about having a fever. And everybody in the world tweeted that again. There were like 1,500 retweets of Lindsay Lohan's original tweet that said, "I'm feeling kind of sick." You know, really? She wasn't sick. She was probably drunk or hungover. One of those two things. Or what? Or I guess it could have been that. I don't know that she looks like that to me. But anyway. Or maybe she was late for court. Who knows? You know, there was one individual who talked about a guy next to him coughing on the train and how he was going to give him a mask. And I thought, gee, that's pretty weird. That was another 1,000 times that was retweeted. So remember that your information can be picked up and shared abundantly. At times, the research taught me that it was more important for change agents, that's us, to stay behind the scenes and let somebody else be a mouthpiece. And that's the kind of thing I was talking about with planting information with your students or with other people who tweet positively about you. Let them be the mouthpiece because they have more validity in the community than you do. You're just empowering individuals to share your information. And if you do this, you'll create a team of defenders for your school, for your university, for your organization. It won't be you by yourself, and that's an awesome thing. You know, you've created a community, and you have the capacity to share this information and get these people to defend your borders. Okay, so I'm going to go through a series of don'ts and do's. I'm starting off with the don'ts because we're supposed to always end positively. So don't share information that's unworthy of your followers. Don't ignore your followers' legitimate concerns. Don't waste time sharing useless information, and don't ignore misinformation. We also can't spread information that you can't confirm. Don't abuse your followers' trust. And if I could say any one thing, it is be trustworthy and be honest. And if you don't know the answer, find the answer or tell somebody you don't know the answer. And don't use Twitter without pondering the ramifications. For your schools who don't use Twitter, I would say if you can't commit 110% to it, then don't do it at all. I think doing it inadequately and not being able to monitor it is worse than not doing it at all. For instance, I have one of the deans in my college, and we don't have departments. We have, you know, just individual deans because the law school is structured differently. One of my deans set up a Twitter account 6 months ago, and they have tweeted once from it, despite the fact that students have at-replied her, have asked for information directly, have had concerns, have had software issues, have had numerous problems. They have not gotten a response. Now, how does that put up her department? I mean, how would you feel? Who? Because they said follow them. Because they said do it, you know? But the do's are even more fun. Please accept the importance of this medium. I think it is, and I actually got one of my professors to say, at the end of the whole rigmarole, well, you've convinced me it's important. Okay, we should do more research. Do build your relationships before emergencies and crises happen. Share your salient information and then harness the power of your network. Encourage people to question. That's important. Call attention to misinformation, but in a nice way. Fill the information vacuum and then reduce uncertainty and verify your own information or allow somebody to verify it for you. I'm just going to run through this slide. And do y'all have any questions? Because Robin's telling me 5 minutes. Any questions? What you got? Well, the question that she asked, if you didn't hear, was how to get buy-in from higher-ups, right? Am I hearing that right? And I would say that I work for one of the best people in the world, and if anybody's on Twitter right now, give him a shout-out, JM DePippa. My dean is awesome. He's on Twitter. He believes in it. But I have worked with people who don't, and I still work with people who don't. And I think one of the most important things that I've done in my job right now is to show, for instance, the dean who did not respond to people adding, I collected the list of tweets that she was being sent. And I said, look, this student is communicating with you and you're not responding to them. And then I went and talked to the student, and I said, how did this make you feel? Was this good customer service? You know, how would you like to have a reaction in this forum? And then I could go back to this dean and say, this is unacceptable for this student to have to wait 2 hours to find out that you can't help them, or to find out that there's a simple, you know, workaround for this. Now, I can't say she's totally been persuaded, but I think showing them the number of people that you have engaged through the medium is important. Showing them examples of how things pay off from us is a good thing. I mean, I know Logan, this is a different social media. You're getting another shout out, yay. But I know Logan has had terrific success with Facebook and responding on Facebook. Well, it's the same concept with Twitter. So I know that I'm open to talk to anybody. I know that a lot of us are open to talk to anybody and to help you come up with a plan. Maybe the plan is that you start communicating with the medium about things that are important to that individual. For instance, I will have a dean who doesn't do anything communication-wise, but she always wants me to tweet about an event that's happening for Pro Bono Week. And it was like, you know, the first year I did it, she got a really good response, and students said they did it because of Twitter. They came in because of Twitter. So, you know, you have to kind of establish the metrics and then let them talk for it. Does anybody have?
Mm-hmm. But have you ever, I guess, what would your response be to, you do have an account? For example, my institution, admissions, does pretty well with their social networking, but then they don't know what to do with the accounts once those students are at the university. And they brought it up with, like, student affairs. Mm-hmm. But student affairs can't designate that time to those accounts.
Because
they don't, like, admissions has a specific social mm-hmm. networking person, but student affairs is not.
Right. And I feel like I need to, I think that's bullshit. You have time. And I mean, and that's, and I hear that a lot too. I don't have time to do this. And I'm like, so what about the time when you're checking your email? It's the same thing. What about the time when you're surfing YouTube at lunch? It's the same thing. Maybe there is somebody in the department who can carve out 10 minutes a day just to pay attention to this channel. Maybe there is somebody in the department who is on Twitter already, but just in a private sense, and so they're interested and they can devote the time to it. Sometimes, as communicators, it's important for us to just take on roles that we don't necessarily want to take on. So probably in that instance, I would say, okay, well, let's just look at how many tweets you get a day, and let's try to, you know, work in. Mike, you're holding up your hand, and I think you probably have a solution for.
Is this directly about Facebook or Twitter?
Well,
completely
both.
Okay, so just one piece of advice that I can give if I come from Facebook. I like to lead through students through that we follow the same kind of path with class up groups. But after that happens, I always use the orientation leaders on campus. So I look at the bridge, like June to September, to invite them to that.
And I think that's an awesome idea. Law students are funny because they say they don't have time either. They don't have time. But amazingly enough, I found quite a few of them on Twitter and on Facebook. Does anybody have anything else? Any other questions, comments? You got one?
Got their own things going, but when it comes to stuff like this, it's more like, why do they even need all this stuff? Like, speaking of admission, for example, because they're really into this social media thing. So, how do you get buy-in from technical people? Is it the same process?
Who aren't inherently social anyway. I don't think that's right.
But then what?
Yeah. I don't, you know, I think you're in a balancing situation because it has to be persuasive to get them to do it. And they may not inherently see the value of communicating as a whole. Does that make sense?
Yeah, they tend to be
well-known. And I mean, we, as a group, we kind of balance on this. It's interesting watching people interact in this group. Tom and I were talking about that. It's interesting watching, you know, we have people who are like, blah, blah, blah. And then we have people who are like, just give me my iPhone. So you have to figure out a way. And maybe the way to do that is to find people on Twitter or find people on Facebook or find people in other medium who have something in common. You know, do you code this way? Do you do this? You know, so you're helping them establish a network where they see the value of the channel. Does that make sense?
So that they might be interested in.
Exactly. Exactly.